You don't need a system outage to know when your PPE isn't delivering what it should. Maybe pricing takes an extra step to verify, maybe updates are taking longer than expected, maybe your team has built workarounds just to keep loans moving. What starts as a few small delays can gradually become the way the work gets done. The reality is, a modern PPE should do more than provide pricing. It should deliver real-time accuracy, seamless workflow execution, intelligent automation, and the confidence to act without hesitation. It should help your team move faster, operate more efficiently, and focus on performance, not process. So ask yourself, is your PPE helping your organization perform at its full potential, or is it forcing your team to work around its limitations? Take a closer look at what you should expect from a modern pricing engine. Visit optimalblue.com/optimalblueppe. Again, that's optimalblue.com/optimalblueppe. Stop accepting friction as part of the process. Make sure your PPE is helping your team move faster, execute smarter, and capture every opportunity.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to the show, everybody. Thank you again for listening here for our first podcast of August. I got a really good show, as always, today. In the interest of keeping you informed, we're always going to strive to bring you up to the hour current events and how we should think about them, whether we're originators, hedgers, capital markets folks, or just anyone interested in the mortgage industry or some good market commentary. So we will kick it off here in a moment with the market update with James and Alex. Then we've got a bit of a new segment that we may do regularly on the podcast. I mean, we're always out there talking to clients, talking to originators, asking what's new in the industry and what they need to be successful, right? We don't talk about it a ton on this podcast. We produce, the best in the industry in terms of capital markets product, in terms of technology. So we're always out there, again, listening to the masses and understanding what's coming down the road and making sure that we're prepared for it and that we're able to support it. So we'll talk a little bit with Kevin about just what are we hearing out there and what are clients telling us they need and what things have we rolled out recently to accommodate. Before we get to the market update, in the way of data, certainly seeing a little bit of a spike in rates, higher than we've seen in quite a while, 6.7 on the OBMMI, that's 30-year conventional fixed. The 10-year is a main driver of that. The 10-year's just been creeping up a few basis points a day, so we're just under 4.7 there. So that spread, 2%, is still holding between mortgage rates and the 10-year. So volume has finally slowed a little bit, lock volume, but not in any meaningful way, honestly. This year is still quite a bit better in terms of volume than we saw in 2025 and of course, 2024 and 23. Still just seeing a really good rebound on volume. We talked about it on a couple webinars last week, just really sort of an unsung story that's going on right now is despite rates being stubbornly high and probably high for a very long time, there's a lot of reasons why we're seeing volume just continue to come in and the borrowers and home buyers in particular just being fairly resilient. So let's get right into the market update, which has a lot to do with where rates are going right now and where rates have moved over the past few weeks. James, Alex, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, as always.
Good morning.
Probably good to start with the FOMC meeting last week. So there was an FOMC meeting, as always, as we know, and we kind of educate our friends and family. Just because the Fed moves rates doesn't mean mortgages are going to get more expensive or cheaper. And if the Fed does nothing, which is what they did last week, they did not change rates. But there was still fairly big market reaction, and that reaction is continuing today, I believe, 4 days after that meeting. Like, what did we get out of that meeting? And what are some of the maybe renewed or new concerns that are out there around this new regime, the Kevin Warsh regime of the Federal Reserve?
I think broadly speaking, the remaining concern is the lack of forward guidance and the hands-off approach, if you will, that the Warsh Fed has so far been pursuing. They once again came out swinging and saying that he's not going to provide any forward guidance. He wants the market to digest the data and the market to play the ball, stop playing the referee. That was what he said during the press conference. As you said, no change in rates this time around. I think a good signal of how the market is reacting to this no forward guidance is heading into this decision 10 minutes before. If you were looking at the CME futures, one third of participants were still saying that there was going to be a hike. Two thirds were saying no hike. So yeah, the majority were saying that there was not going to be a hike of any sort. But if you went back and maybe looked at, 10 minutes before a Powell presser, last year sometime, usually we saw those CME numbers locked in at 95, 99%, just because of how well forward they were guiding themselves. Granted, this environment's a little bit different with this emergent inflation. We've seen a bit of a divide on the FOMC council itself. There were three votes actually to hike rates by 25 basis points. Hammock, Kashkari, and Logan, those three have been outspoken on being hawkish on inflation in the past as well. So I think that's the number one thing the market is still coming to grips with in regards to Kevin Warsh's Fed is how do you play the ball? How do you stop playing the referee as they have been for years now in the post-global financial crisis? The Fed made no change to that overnight rate, but the Treasury markets, especially the long end of the curve, the 10 and 30 year, both rallied rate-wise quite significantly towards the end of last week out of that Fed meeting. The 30 year topped out at about 5.25%, a little under that this morning if rates have backed off a little bit. But I think there's an argument to be made there that, the market is potentially pricing in hikes ahead of time. I mean, they are pricing in hikes ahead of time, but it seems to be pretty aggressive at this point. We've seen pretty aggressive changes in those Treasury rates over the past week.
I very much read the reaction that day, right? It almost felt going into the meeting, as you said, 30% of the CME or 33% was saying, hey, we might actually see the rate cut today. So the pricing in the market that morning was trying to build in the possibility of a rate hike already. And when that did not manifest, we actually saw an alleviation in the pricing in the market very quickly from, right after the Fed announcement until about 3 p.m. And then come 3 p.m., it's almost like someone came out and they said, well, hey, does this mean the Fed might be too slow, right? Like, are we going to have to keep rates higher for longer in the future because we didn't do it now? And all of a sudden, the Treasury just came swinging right back, right? We got above 4.7 twice in the past week. We're at about 4.69 right now. So just teasing it on the 10-year. So it very much felt like there was a lack of certainty around what might happen. And once it was clarified, everyone had to recalibrate. What do we think about the future now? And is the Fed moving quick enough? Maybe not. We played this game before. The one of the main things Warsh had been hammering on was, hey, I think the Fed was too slow to raise and lower rates last time around. So there was the possibility that he was going to hike them this time because he, wants to act fast.
Yeah, that's an interesting take as well. And I think you're right. Yeah, there's this underlying, just a little bit of a panic, it feels like. And when the investors are in doubt, they're going to sell probably right into this market. And the long end of the curve is always going to be more volatile, right? It's going to move faster. And we're certainly seeing that the last few days. And it that heavily affects mortgage rates because it is better tied to the 30-year treasury than it is the 10-year, although the 10 is a lot more common, obviously, in terms of quoting it and using it in these conversations. All right. Anything else to talk about regarding the Fed in the short term?
We didn't get any real feedback yet on his working groups that he set up, those five working groups he announced at his first Fed meeting. So I still am just kind of keeping a tab on that, see what the takeaways are from those groups as they get up and running. But, looking forward towards the September meeting, I'm just going to continue to hammer on it that inflation is going to be, on the front burner. We will get two rounds of CPI and PPI between now and the September meeting, as well as a PCE release. We can hope to see those inflation markings come down, but that's really going to be contingent on geopolitical developments.
Yeah, it feels like it would be a minor miracle to see a two handle across the board on all of these measurements by the September meeting. So the Fed has to act at that point. Otherwise, they start looking slow, like the Jerome Powell administration was accused of, right? Just waiting too long to let this inflation thing play out and possibly reignite or get hotter. Otherwise, what should we be watching in terms of not just the Fed, but just what is driving interest rates? I mean, the national debt of our country is one of those things. We talk about it a lot here. And the fact that treasury rates are going up only exacerbates that, right? We're already paying $1 trillion a year in interest as a nation, as taxpayers. So, you know, you add 10 basis points to the 10-year. I haven't done the math, but that's a lot. Way into the, you know, into the billions of dollars that are, we're just paying for air. We're paying just to continue borrowing money. The AI trade is another piece of it. All of the these companies that are investing heavily in AI, whether it's Meta, Google, Microsoft, server farms that are being built, nuclear reactors that are being invested in, foreign debt of these countries that have to rearm themselves in a continually unstable geopolitical environment. I mean, what else can we throw on the fire there that's just pushing rates higher?
Right. I think when you look on a, you know, 5 to 10 year timeline, the geopolitical and the global debt picture looks pretty precipitous. You know, coming out of the COVID era, the US national debt's well over, you know, 100% GDP to national debt. And yeah, it seems painful. To your point, you know, the refinancing of the US national debt is happening all the time. There's constantly auctions of varying maturities. And one thing I've been kind of keeping tabs on over the course of the past week, and this got caught up in the news cycle as well, you know, kind of a B-roll picture of some notes from a meeting where Scott Bessent had written, you know, U.S. to buy 5 to 10 billion Japanese yen. And late last week, we saw some pretty significant moves in the exchange rate there between USD and Japanese yen. Both the Bank of Japan, the National Bank of Japan, as well as the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, were doing open market operations to prop up the value of the yen. The yen has been extremely weak and declining in value for some time now. And, you know, that raised the question, you know, they are, you know, Japan's an ally, they're a friend of ours, but, you know, you have to ask the question of, you know, I don't think we would just be going out and buying yen out of the goodness of our hearts. And so, you know, a lot of the news media that I have read is that, you know, the Bank of Japan was saying we have to buy yen to prop up the currency. And to do that, they were saying that they may need to sell U.S. treasuries. They're a massive holder of U.S. treasuries to finance that buying of yen. So, you know, I think we could see that that open market operation is in part to, you know, stem the raising of those rates that we've been talking about this whole podcast, those 10, 30 years. Don't want to see more selling pressure out of Japan on U.S. treasuries.
That is exactly how I was looking at this one as well. Korea right now is experiencing a real stock market sell-off over the past 2 months. They are getting crushed. This is a shocking stat to me, but one in every 30 adults in Korea has been margin called, like, since July. That's preposterous. but their stock market is crushing itself, and very, you know, relationally closely tied Japan. They do have stock market, you know, relation. The market's not going quite the right direction. The currency in Japan is starting to slip. They have to take action, and that can negatively impact U.S. rates. Well, you know, we can step in and do a little helping there to stop that from happening, because, right, we're flirting with that 4.7. If things go the wrong way, we could be flirting with 4.8, 4.9. And that is on the 10-year, just absolutely not what we want to see pressure on.
Right. So it could be worth the U.S. continuing to intervene in buying Japanese yen on our own to try to create a little bit of scarcity there to put a floor underneath that value, right?
Correct. It seems to be in our interest to be helping Japanese here keep that currency at some value.
That stock market stat is crazy too. That, I mean, that indicates a lot of risk being taken by a lot of investors. One out of 30 investors is using margin. Most, like, American,
yes,
casual investors do not trade on margin, right? So margin, for those of you who don't use it, is means you're borrowing money to buy stocks and bonds in, with the intention of making money and then selling and paying back that debt. But you're obviously investing more than you own. So anyway, that's one out of 30 is a tremendous number. I would doubt that one in 1,000 American investors is utilizing a margin account.
Yeah, that's where, like, it's shocking because it's so high, one in 30, but is it also just that enough people are either using options or taking leverage that they could be margin called. Is one in 30 people could be doing that is really an aggressive market.
Yes, and they're underwater. That many are have made the wrong bet. they're getting called. They have to find cash or liquidate their positions to pay off that debt. That's the sort of thing that can lead to a compounding effect that can cause a market crash, right? As everyone is forced to sell to pay off their debt. And we're not saying that's going to happen here, but that's what you start thinking about. That's what happened in 07 and 08 in the US and across the world with just some of the options and insurance policies and derivatives that were caving in as everybody was forced at some point to liquidate.
And as people are forced to liquidate, it can create that spiral where the stock market is pressing down. And so foreign investors would try and get out. And if foreign investors are trying to get out, they're selling your currency, which is going to depreciate the value of your currency. So someone needs to step in and bottom out your currency.
Right. Which, you know, the Japanese central banks have been, they've made no secret that they believe the government pegs certain aspects of their economy, such as their treasury rates, and I think their currency to some level. So they're not against intervention, but there is a point where that can you can lose control of that. It sounds like we're a bit worried about that.
It's definitely something to be keeping your eye on for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. Now hopefully that one works itself out.
If you pull up a USD to Japanese yen chart, you can see directly where the interventions happened. It'll pop, you know, a tenth of a cent, which is might not sound like a lot, but it's that's a lot when it comes to, you know, the value of a foreign currency. And if we see, you know, it steadily give that back, that would indicate potentially needs for additional support, or also that again, the market forces here are, you know, calling the bluff and saying, you know, this currency isn't really worth what you're propping it up to. So remains to be seen how successful this open market operation is. And just for some historical context, the last time this was done was in 2011, when that massive earthquake combined with the Fukushima nuclear disaster impacted Japan.
Yeah, great info. Definitely something to watch out for. There's, you know, generally speaking, equity markets have been strong in the Western world over the last, you know, 5 years, but we tend to follow each other and there's been a lot of profits made. So like you were saying, James, if selling starts to beget more selling, some folks are going to just decide to throw those gains off the table, even if they've diminished somewhat over the past few months. So something to watch in terms of just equity that's out there. And also as it relates back to our own interest rates in this country, if Japan or any other nation needs to start selling large amounts of treasuries to finance propping up their own markets.
And if I can make one more, you know, potential path for contagion for this, is these open market operations are boosting the value of the yen. Last year, we were talking quite a bit about the yen carry trade, where you borrow in yen and then you purchase, you know, assets in the West that are higher yielding, and then you pay back that loan in Japan. But, you know, if, you know, we're seeing the value of the yen be artificially brought up to a certain level, we could see, you know, some of these financial institutions that are using that yen carry trade be caught out by, you know, an open market operation, and the yen is now trading at a more positive value than they were expecting it to. So if they run into a number of concurrent events, they could also be put in pain there.
Absolutely. Good points there. Again, probably a major thing to watch in the short term. Speaking of short term, what do we have on tap this week? It's unemployment week, obviously, so that's big. So we've got lots of numbers around that. You want to run us through those here, James?
Yeah, so I'd be watching out for Wednesday. We'll have ADP. It's going to come out around just before 8:30. It's 8:15 a.m. ADP is, you know, not like the official number that you should look at, but it's always kind of a good barometer of where we're heading, future tense. Thursday, we'll have the jobless claims. We were a little bit better last week than was expected. So watch out just to see if we are keeping on a healthy trend or slipping back up towards about 200,000 on the jobless, which is the expectation at the moment. And then Friday, of course, is the employment report. It'll come out at 8:30 a.m. Eastern. We're expecting it. It's not a grand slam of a economic report this time. It looks like 85,000 is roughly the expected job gain, which is, you know, not high enough. It's not where we'd like to be, but compared to the previous, which was below 60,000, it's still an improvement. The unemployment rate has been hovering around 4.3. It did get down to 4.2 last release. It looks like the expectation has us back up at 4.3. But my question is always, you know, has the denominator changed? As more people go without jobs for longer, are they no longer in the survey? And so do things improve or get worse based on that? I think that this number will probably be pretty static for the medium term.
Yeah, that sounds right. Lackluster, you know, like you said, nothing, not a grand slam, 85,000, but with some of the changes to migration patterns, but also the job participation rate, as you said, that you should also watch on Friday. We're managing to stay well below 4.5, which until we get to 4.5, it seems super unlikely that the Fed is going to focus on employment as a concern in their dual mandate. They're going to continue just watching CPI, which means they're going to lean more towards hikes than cuts. Alex, anything you would add on the job stuff to look at this week?
Just always, you know, continue to dig into the numbers. I note this one quite a bit. Kevin Warsh, he's big on the productivity gains that AI could bring to the economy. But as I think we're all quite aware at this point, there are concerns about what, you know, AI disruption could do to the labor market. So I like to look at the those with a bachelor's degree, ages 20 to 24, that unemployment rate, that number comes out with those non-farm numbers each month, just because it's expected that, you know, those entry-level white-collar work is going to be the first to see pain from, you know, mass AI adoption. So that's one I would keep an eye on. But other than that, I'm really just going to be watching the headline number for any pop to either side. But like you said, I don't expect us to be bringing labor back to the forefront unless we get a string of bad releases.
Yeah, that's a good thing to remind folks of, to look at that very specific demographic, because that's likely to be the first shoe to fall, right? The white collar, sort of the analyst right out of college, if you will, that gets hired to run spreadsheets and build reports and presentations and things that we all use AI for right now, because it does a decent job of it, right? You may need half as many of those type of new hires going forward if AI gets, you know, however many orders of magnitude smarter. That's the one argument. The other argument is you just get more productive, you hire just as many people. So we'll all be watching for that on Friday leading up to it. All those other numbers you mentioned, James, that kind of give us a little peek into what's going on with jobs, and especially that initial claims. Still super interesting that we saw a record low in that number just 2 weeks ago. We used to say 220 was a decent number, and now we've kind of set the bar lower. So 200 is kind of that bogey. If we're under 200, we're doing really well. But if we break 200, then maybe we're talking about rates going lower. All right, gentlemen, anything else?
That just about covers us.
Beautiful. Yeah, thanks so much. Okay, as promised, I have Kevin Foley with us today. We're going to do a little chat about just what are we hearing from customers, right? We are out constantly, whether we're, you know, on Teams calls with clients. Kevin and I are actually going to a couple of different conferences, industry conferences next week. He'll be at the Housing Wire AI conference, I believe, and I'll be at the CMBA Western Secondary out in California. But we're always just listening to customers. In fact, we have a whole group that deals with things like escalating what we are hearing from clients, what they need to be successful due to any changes in the industry or just changes in the way that mortgage banks do business. So we thought it'd be good to kind of collect some intel on that from across our teams and just highlight a few things that are hot right now, just a couple hot topics, and just generally how are lenders out there being successful at addressing some of these new hot topics in the industry. And some of them not super new, but every month they kind of evolve a little bit. And maybe we kick off with the first one here, which is not new, but growing, non-QM. So we're talking about non-qualified mortgages, right? Depending on how you look at them, we've on this podcast talked about how it's not, you know, the subprime or the Alt-A of the early 2000s, but it's also not GSE eligible loans. That's the point. It's this kind of in the middle where there's clearly these groups of borrowers that are underserved by the GSEs or Ginnie Mae because they're not first-time home buyers. They may not have traditional types of income. They may own multiple properties. Whatever their deal is, they are, you know, common sense wise should be eligible to borrow money, but just can't because they don't quite fit in the box. But non-QM has grown. It's about 10% of what we see in our systems today. If you go back a couple of years, it was 5%, and before that, it was close to 0%. But again, growing. And we have had to make some moves to accommodate because there's, again, this is not GSE eligible loans, which is GSE eligible has been kind of the only game in town since the great financial crisis, but non-QM has picked up significantly over this last few years. Kevin, what are you hearing in terms of what people need and what lenders are doing to be successful in that realm of the industry?
Yeah, so it's a great question. We went out for this episode. We did a little bit of field work and trying to collect some anecdotes from folks on just the latest developments in these areas. So for non-QM, just a few stats, like you said, right around 10%. You can see that in our Market Advantage report, which we cover here, monthly basis, an Optimal Insights podcast. And the breakdown for that is about a third DSCR type loans, a third bank statement loans, and then a third all others. So it's pretty evenly split between those categories, those buckets. We're seeing more anecdotes from lenders who are moving away from this as, you know, I'm dipping my toe in, or I'm just trying to kind of get a feel for it, figure it out, to lenders expanding their volume in these products. And you know, there's generally pretty healthy margins with these products as well, which is supports lender profitability. We also happy to announce we did a big update in the last couple of months, expanding Optimal Blue support for non-QM. So we rolled out support for short-term rental. We rolled out support for first-time investor, equity vesting, also a number of new income verification types related to bank statements, some additional support in areas for DSCR. So we are staying very close to the pulse on what lenders as well as investors are looking for with non-QM, and we're rolling out enhancements to support that. But one other thing I would highlight is there's been a lot more discussion, I will say, around non-QM hedging and how to potentially hedge non-QM in-house and then ultimately deliver that to investors. So, you know, getting away from best efforts transactions. Still very, I would say, early in that. I think that's the sort of thing that's not every lender profile is going to be a great fit for non-QM hedging. I am hearing that as something that's being talked about more. The component that's difficult with hedging non-QM is of course, the credit risk. You can hedge your interest rate risk, but if you end up in a situation where credit spreads widen, then, you know, that could be an area where, unless you're prepared for that, you could be more exposed from a hedging perspective. And there aren't a ton of great instruments for credit risk hedging at the moment, on par with, let's say, like TBAs for, you know, MBS, you know, duration, convexity, interest rate risk. I worked closely with a lender actually back in the late 2010s who had brought on some folks. They built a whole department to, you know, build out their own white labeled non-QM products, or own products that they eventually hedged and sold on a mandatory basis to investors. Then when COVID happened, that was a very, very big disruption. So just as a reminder for everyone, a refresher, when COVID happened, we had the Fed coming out saying they were buying unlimited MBS. It pushed, you know, UMBS way, the yield on that way down. So prices went way up, but then credit spreads widened. So you had two moves kind of moving in opposite directions, created a lot of difficulty for investors A lot of folks were just scrambling to get production off of their books. And the lender that I'd worked closely was selling some loans for 80 cents on the dollar, you know, by the tail end of it. So we are seeing more folks get into that area, or at least discuss getting into that area. That's something that we're looking, you know, pretty closely at and talking to folks about. And in terms of like hedging strategies around credit risk, you know, some of the things that I've looked up that seem like the best tools would be more like high yield ETF puts, like super out of the money, because the types of instruments that you're going to want to protect yourself with are going to be the ones that are going to work well in that crisis environment, a credit explosion environment. The credit spreads widen pretty substantially. And for that, you're looking at things like, you know, high yield ETF puts, low grade bonds, shorts. But all of these are, you know, they're going to have different, you know, different benefits and different drawbacks associated with them. But if you are considering this, the one thing I would say is try and as best you can bake some of that option, the cost of those puts, the cost of the hedge, into what you are modeling out, so that you can incorporate that ultimately into the pricing. Anyways, those are some anecdotes around what we're hearing with non-QM. Again, more folks getting into it. Some recent updates from Optimal Blue to help support some of those newer areas. And then also more conversation around hedging non-QM and some of the risks associated with that.
Yeah, well, that's great stuff, Kevin. That's a lot to unpack there. If I was going to paraphrase, right? Good pointing out that there's all these additional fields that are needed now. So as we mentioned, there's these different aspects of sort of the borrower profile that haven't really been an issue for the last 20 years since the great financial crisis. But now as you're interviewing borrowers, there's more questions you can ask them that could fit them into a non-QM loan program, whereas otherwise they may have not been approved for an FHA, VA conventional loan. So those fields are up and running, ready to go. A lot more lenders adopting non-QM and having that alternative to some of those more common, more liquid products. Then there's the question of hedging. Should I hedge this stuff to try to make more money off of it? As you said, not one size fits all. If you're doing $100 million a month of the stuff, absolutely talk to us about hedging it. If you're not, there's a cohort in there that should be likely just locking these things best efforts. Otherwise, yeah, apparently you're on your E-Trade account trading, you know, ETFs to hedge your pipeline, which is a little bit of an interesting proposition. In fact, during COVID, that was one of the things that was pointed out was the only way you could have really made money hedging conventional loans during that absolute crisis would have been to short the S&P, you know, just to short stocks in general, because that's where the money would have been made, is when everybody else was losing. And yeah, like that sort of credit disruption is very seldom, very unlikely. So kind of if you're, you know, producing a significant amount of non-QM every month, you can weather a storm like that if you build it into your pricing and build up some sort of reserve, which I think is what you were alluding to there. You wouldn't want to price this the way you would price a conventional loan, because conventional loan margins are extremely thin, but also that product is very, very liquid. There's not an undefined credit box. If there is a crisis, it is likely that the U.S. government steps in and backstops something like that versus a non-QM loan, which will have theoretically no backing at all, right? If those loans fail, the investor holding that paper will incur that cost. Good stuff. Anyway, we're here to talk through those things, whether you're trying to price it, sell those on the secondary market, or even hedge non-QM. So sort of related to this in terms of interviewing clients, trying to qualify more borrowers, there's these new scoring models that have come out, right? FICO 10T, Vantage Score, there's additional credit models now on top of classic FICO, which we've used in the mortgage industry for many decades and are now making, you know, potentially making a shift towards having a better selection of models. What are you hearing from folks in terms of those new models right now?
Yeah, so I think my punchline is we're probably going to know a lot more by the end of the year, and it still feels like it's very early. So a little bit of background. VantageScore, kind of an interesting story there. It's, Optimal Blue rolled out support for a new credit score model field that supports Classic FICO, VantageScore, as well as FICO 10T. So all that's supported within Optimal Blue from a pricing, from an eligibility perspective. We're mapping that to and from LOSs where we can for those who are supporting that as well. This was a very quick, fast conversation that happened that sort of came together. And because there are a lot of different ways to do this. Do we do borrower level fields? Do we do, you know, one single loan level field? And you know, Optimal Blue helped kind of pioneer and lead a lot of those conversations to coalesce around that one loan level credit score model field, which the industry is sort of coalescing on as well. So a little bit of a plug there, just since I was involved in some of those conversations, but we're super excited to get that out. And the early data that we're seeing is a lot of lenders are still thinking about adopting alternative credit score models. They might be still researching, but not a lot of activity yet. And like I said at the beginning, very interested to see what this looks like towards the end of the year, because I think that's going to be the big tell. We are hearing that especially some of the bigger lenders are jumping in a little bit quicker, probably those with, you know, bigger compliance departments, you know, just more resources to put at the problem and figure out exactly where that fits in your overall strategy. Now, I mean, the good news here is from a pricing perspective, that's not what lenders need to be worrying about. It's not what lenders need to be focused on. That's all covered here. But I'm sure there's a lot of conversations that are going on around how are we going to expect, do we do one score? Do we do both scores? How are we going to see these loans perform over time from a prepay, from a, you know, credit perspective, delinquency perspective? That seems to be the sentiment that I'm hearing from lenders when we're going out and asking for feedback. But yes, so far it seems like it's kind of a slow early adoption. A lot of lenders still thinking about it and very interested. I'm sure that this is going to be a much, much larger percentage towards the end of the year. I'm just interested in how quickly that ramps up.
Yeah, that's a good overview, Kevin. Glad we're prepared and we feel confident that borrowers don't, or that our clients don't need to worry about the pricing side of this. We're geared up for however it ultimately plays out in terms of an actual announcement from the GSEs on how it will be priced, but we're set up for however that works out. But we are working with many of the pilot lenders who have already rolled out VantageScore, so we have a lot of information on it from that perspective. We had Ricard Bandebeau from VantageScore. He's the chief strategy officer from VantageScore on a couple of weeks ago, and he was posting some early numbers, and the securitizations that are utilizing VantageScore are increasing exponentially. And a lot of that is the large lenders, as you mentioned. It's Rocket, it's New Res, it's UWM, and so on, that are heavily adopting these, where each of those big lenders, they're like 15 to 20% of what they're producing is using VantageScore. That still translates to a very small percentage of overall securitizations, call it 2%. But that was 0% just a few months ago. So seeing some good adoption there. So it does feel like these new credit models are here. It's just going to take, like you said, second half of the year, maybe we see it really ramp up and we start talking about, you know, FICO has new models that are being designed and coming out soon. And they already have FICO 10T out there. So you would assume that's going to be in the lexicon, if you will, going forward too. Still a lot to be discovered, but in any case, we're trading those loans currently and folks are locking them in our PPE. And again, it's just another thing you can use, another weapon you have to try to win deals. When you have maybe a borrower has early credit, not a lot of credit lines, maybe they're a little bit low on the scale and you could boost them up with, you know, with things like rent and other things that may not be accounted for in all the different models that are out there. So you have options. Options are good. All right. So last thing I think is always a question. It's going to be a question that we will be either presenting on or listening to or on a panel next week talking about at our respective conferences, AI. Like, you know, where's AI today in terms of the mortgage industry? Who's using it? Where is it actually practical to use it? You know, what's the true adoption? We actually just talked about it on our market update a few minutes ago. It's you know, where are we actually seeing value created, or where are we seeing efficiency created in this market?
Yeah, I think that's still a big question. And even for folks at a macroeconomic level who are trying to look for the ROI and all of this AI capital expenditure investments, you know, data centers, et cetera. It's a huge chunk of our annual GDP right now. I mean, by huge, it's, I think, somewhere in like the 2% range, but that's for a single, you know, investment build out. It's, you know, on par with, you know, broadband, the internet, getting closer to things like the national highway system, for instance. So all this money being spent, where is the ROI? And I think at the macroeconomic level, some of the answers are still elusive. But there are definitely, once you sort of peel back layers of the onion within our industry, I think a lot of opportunities for ROI. I'm going to be talking about that next week at the Housing Wire AI Summit. I have a sit down with Sarah Wheeler from Housing Wire. Nice. Very excited about it. And the topic is going to be looking beyond the model. And so conversation around who's the better model provider. Is it OpenAI? Is it ChatGPT? Google was in the conversation for a period of time, Anthropic, Claude, et cetera. And I don't think that that is really the question that we need to be asking ourselves or the question that we need to be worried about. And I think a lot of the opportunity exists within the institutional data that we all have, our institutional context. You know, this is the sort of the information that's contained within an enterprise, within an organization. A lot of it, you know, lives in folks' heads. A lot of it might be, you know, written down about how your systems work and what is that secret sauce that gives your company an edge versus, you know, the many other companies that are out there. Whether that's a mortgage company, whether that's a technology company, whatever footprint that you're operating in. And so that's where I think the real value add is. I don't want to give too much away about the talk, but I do think that when you think about what is like the lowest hanging fruit for opportunities for AI adoption, I think knowledge agents are a big number one. So knowledge agents can help you harness that institutional knowledge that exists. Think about it as like a wiki or a, you know, a chatbot that can answer questions that folks in your enterprise might have about whatever it might be, you know, how your systems work or how to get data out of certain systems. And, you know, those were some of the, you know, back kind of going back now, this was a year and a half, 2 years ago, were the some of the first areas where we had at Optimal Blue where we had invested in knowledge agents and, you know, things like Ask Obi that allows you to pull answer questions on any of your data within the pricing engine and now within the hedging and trading systems as well and get very specific answers to specific questions. Are you our hedging agents that we have to help you through understanding your position, understanding what trades that you should take. And we also have going to be launched this week, actually, are the Virtual Economist, which is a knowledge agent that sits on top of proprietary machine learning models that can help develop customized interest rate and lock volume forecasts under a variety of macroeconomic scenarios to help you better plan for how to grow your business. So that is definitely an opportunity. And then, you know, I'll talk a little bit more about when I'm at the Housing Wire AI conference, how lenders can go about making that happen. That is definitely an area where I think a lot of lenders are still trying to figure out, you know, maybe you're more familiar with AI tools, you're more familiar with how to use them, but how to identify areas that have higher ROI and then go and deploy solutions to solve those problems. That's an area where I think a lot of lenders are still are today.
Right. That's a really great way to think about it. And it certainly does seem to be playing out. And it's the way we think about it at Optimal Blue. Yeah, all these large language models are trying to do the same thing. They're designed to do the same thing, to encounter a problem and try to solve it and try to find resources to do that. So sometimes it's for a lot of tech companies like us and then all the way down to our clients, to the lenders, it's about how you connect that model to the right resources to solve the problem. Some of it might be proprietary data, which is super important. Or if you have a proprietary model, like you said, whether it's machine learning or another type of model that solves a problem, if that problem is finding borrowers or knowing where to post your leads to bring borrowers in the door, or to find the right loan program for that borrower. And it goes on forever, right? It's the deployment of that model versus, yeah, maybe the underlying debate of which model is better, which is probably not the best thing to talk about, because by the time you've had the conversation, that model has rolled out a new version of itself, and that's going to continue happening over the next couple of years and decades as well. So these, in my mind, these models are going to leapfrog each other in terms of their capabilities and their speed and their efficiency, but it's how you deploy it. It's how you, everyone's talking about AI now. We have, sometimes it's like, it's
oversaturation,
too much. Yes. It's just, you have to have AI. If you're not AI enabled, what are you doing? And it's just not, AI is not for everything still. It doesn't, it's not going to solve every problem today. It's just not the most efficient way in a lot of cases. Sometimes machine learning is, or sometimes you have, again, you have your own data that's driving your decisions versus this model that's just looking for good information versus the sort of the omniscient being that's going to solve everything today. Yeah, good way to think about it. Yeah, that was great, Kevin. Thank you for cluing us in and educating us on some of these things and helping us all be more successful.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Cool. Thank you, Kevin. Talk soon, man.
Yep.
And that's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.